Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for allowing me to see myself the way you see me. Thank you.
And welcome to Inspired Perspectives, where your host, Paulette Hubbard, will be talking about today men and depression. Inspired, thank you for tuning in, where life is about choices, and where we'll be discussing the issues of life, love, and the pursuit of happiness, and how to become empowered through the power of choice. And I am so excited about our show today, because today we'll be talking about men and depression. And when we talk about men and depression, the problem is that a lot of times depression in men go unrecognized, and it's very uncommon for men to be diagnosed. Every year, depression affects more than 19 million Americans, but men account for only about 10% of diagnosed cases. Because of this, depression was once considered a woman's disease. And today I want to try to pique your awareness on that stereotype, because men also get depressed. And I'm so excited about my guests that I have on the show today. First is Dr. Bullock. Dr. Bullock has 22 years of experience in behavioral health care. He's currently the senior administrator in the behavioral health care field. His experience is in mental health, substance abuse, career counseling, and personal development coaching have allowed him to build his career around personal goals of serving those in, his personal goal of serving those in need. And then I also have Bishop Brian Garner. Pastor Garner, has been in the ministry for over 15 years. He served in just about every capacity of the church, and is the founder of In God's Hands Ministry. He's also a certified addictions counselor with over 12 years of experience, and he's been also blessed to serve professionally in the counseling field as well. He has been the director of substance abuse counseling, worked in hospital treatment centers, and has worked closely with dual diagnosed clients in the court system. In addition, he regularly provides premarital counseling, marital, family, and individual counseling of those in need. And I'd like to welcome both of my guests. Are you there? Are you all there? Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Are you there? Is that Dr. Bullock?
Yes.
How are you today?
I'm doing fine.
Awesome. Bishop Garner, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I'd like to thank you both for coming on the show. I'm so excited to have you here. And what we're going to be talking about today is men and depression, how they deal with it, why it, and I really want to try to get to the root of why it's not as recognizable as it is in women and how it became a women's disease. We're also going to be talking about issues in the church and how those in the church or of different religions view depression and how they see that also. So those are some of the issues that I like to talk about. I guess I want to start with you, Dr. Bullock. I know that in your work, you often see depression in men. What has been some of your experiences with working with men in depression?
Well, generally, just working with men in counseling has been very predominantly a forum where the majority of those men are involved in the criminal justice system as a way of coming in. Very few occasions is it that I have an opportunity to work with a black male who isn't coming from a referral source such as a criminal justice agency. So that in and of itself speaks to some of the barriers to to men without being told they have to go and get some help coming in for services. Once you get past that, then you still have the issue of having to work really hard to develop a trusting atmosphere to be able to really get to the core issues that may be going on. So there's a lot of trust and a lot of work to really separate myself as a therapist from, say, a probation officer or somebody else in the criminal justice system. And so that's one of the things I always start off with in our relationship, therapeutic relationship, is to try to really set myself apart from the criminal justice agencies so that an atmosphere can be developed to where there's enough trust to really deal with some real issues.
Okay. And Bishop Garner, you've also worked within the court system. I think that's interesting that Dr. Bullock is saying that he tries to separate himself from the criminal justice system, whereas you've actually worked within that system in dealing with men. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I will agree with Dr. Bullock that
you certainly need to establish a therapeutic relationship. And in my position as an officer of the court, and yet someone who had to provide clinical services, that was a bit more challenging for me. But the key is establishing that therapeutic relationship and that trust. And I think once you're able to at least show some level of concern and caring, just basic counseling skills, you know, those things that should be inherent in those who are performing this type of task or are responsible for giving this kind of service, it should automatically kick in. And that was always a challenge, that trust factor for someone who's been a career criminal, for example, to have to trust someone who is on the other side, so to speak. That's tough.
And I agree with both of you. And one of the things that we talk about with symptoms of depression in men and why they're not commonly recognized is that men tend to, this question is to both of you, and Ben, from my experience, is that men tend to deny having problems because they're supposed to be strong, you know, and I put that quote-unquote to be strong. How have the both of you worked to get around that or to build rapport with them to work with the depression?
Well, I know for me, you know, again, a lot of it starts with just really trying to build some kind of a connection, and so you find a common ground where you can find a safe subject to discuss, and then from there, you know, you kind of work out to beginning to get into some of the more powerful issues. And I think for me, it has been a matter of letting the men know that you don't have to be perceived as being weak. You don't have to be perceived as being less than because you're dealing with the issue of depression. Obviously, there is a certain stigma attached to depression, and for a lot of men, that's an area that they don't want to go into, they don't want to admit to, they don't want to deal with. It's easier to mask those feelings of depression. And so it's important to let that individual know just what their self-worth is and that it's not an illness of weakness. It's not an illness of shame or both.
And so how, when you're doing that, how are they responsive to that, the way that you bring that to them? Are they responsive to and accepting that? It's because especially society, you know, we get all of these mixed messages from society and from different cultures and ethnicities that that's a sign of weakness for men. So are they receptive to when you talk to them about it not being a sign of weakness?
I think it's a matter of, again, building up that trust and building up the individual, because typically when someone comes to you with that type of issue, there has to be a building up. There's a certain breakdown somewhere in their lives. And so, no, I'm not going to immediately connect on that level. I'm not going to convince someone or try to show someone right away that you know, you're on top of the world. I want to build them up. I want a foundation. I want to give them back whatever was lost. And so, yeah, it's a process. It's a process for me.
Okay. Dr. Bullock, how do you approach that issue of men being seen as weak?
Well, you know, first of all, in the counseling environment, people come to you in two ways. They either come to you in a position where there's things going on and you kind of have to, you know, work to build up a relationship and try to get into core issues. The flip side of that is that you get a client that's in crisis right off the bat. And so most of the focus for an individual at that point is symptom relief. And so in that instance, you know, it's a matter of kind of doing a triage and coming up with something. So, and a lot of times I think you know, a lot of black men have a scenario where they have a pressure cooker kind of a situation, and you know, and reach that breaking point where go into a crisis mode. And so in those instances, you kind of, it's almost like all bets are off, because now you're working with the immediate situation and treating the symptoms, and hopefully, and this is where it gets a little tricky, you'll get some follow-up once things calm down. But sort of more on a traditional kind of a referral, you do have to deal with the reality that men culturally get socialized not to express emotions. There's a high likelihood that the therapist that they will get assigned will probably be non-black and female, so that makes it a lot harder to build any kind of rapport or really break through that sort of cultural orientation to come in and really just, you know, pour your heart out. So that's been my experience.
Okay. Because men are more likely to keep their feelings hidden, and that's what we're talking about, building them up and getting to the core issues, whereas women, you know, the more typical signs are there, the crying, the sadness, loss of interest in previously enjoyed activities, and a lot of times they'll express themselves in that way. Men don't typically do that. So how do you begin to recognize depression in men if they're not displaying those outward symptoms that you would see in women, or that we often see with women?
Well, I think for me, and I'm just I'm looking at it from a spiritual context, when someone comes to me who's dealing with an issue of depression, oftentimes that depression begins to manifest itself in other ways. Sometimes it's drug and alcohol use. Sometimes there are sexual issues. Sometimes there are abuse issues. Then we can begin to deal with those external issues that certainly impact the whole person. And so I'm looking at those types of things that are very impacting on a person. And that points to the way that they're dealing with it, maybe not from an emotional standpoint or from any other standpoint, but seeing the manifestation in other ways and then being able to handle it from there.
Okay. And how about you?
For me, I tend to take a little bit of an expanded perspective and just looking at the whole person, so that the primary focus, for example, on the front end could be a physical concern. A person is frustrated. They've had a lot of ups and downs managing hypertension or diabetes or something of that nature, and part of a way of coping with it might be substance abuse, as well as maybe even some domestic violence. So, you know, those are the kinds of symptoms that in history that kind of come into a relationship. And so as I began to explore some of those areas, and obviously if there's substance abuse, getting a person sober, you begin to see a clinical picture that emerges where some of the symptoms that might be more consistent with depression will sort of stand out. And so, you know, that's looking at it from a whole person perspective, where I'm thinking, the emotional, the mental, the physical, the spiritual, looking at social relationships, even looking at finances, that's another area, and then, of course, legal concerns, all can sort of define that pressure cooker scenario that I described earlier.
Okay, so how, and you said a couple things, drugs and alcohol, both of you said drugs and alcohol are some of the outward symptoms. So are they self-medicating? Are you speaking of self-medicating? In other words, what I've experienced in working with clients is that the deeper they go into depression, the heavier the drug and alcohol use becomes. The more with women, it's shopping. They may do more shopping and excessive spending. But with men, the violence increases. They seem to become more irritable. Are there any other outward signs that if someone was listening in now that they could look for and possibly say, well, maybe I may have a problem, or a friend or a loved one may have a problem, maybe struggling with depression?
Well, I was thinking about something that's very socially acceptable, and that's the habit of working excessively, you know, long hours, just kind of diving into one's profession to kind of take your mind off of what's really going on. That's one way of dealing with depression as an outward sign.
Okay.
I think that, you know, sometimes depression is called the silent illness, similar to high blood pressure, in that if a man has truly cut himself off emotionally, not only from any kind of professional, but in his own living environment, oftentimes very similar to physical problems. You know, when you look at the most common diseases that tend to exacerbate themselves pretty greatly in African American community, like hypertension, diabetes, prostate cancer, some of those things. There's just that sort of cultural hesitancy to go and talk to anybody about a problem until you really get to a point where it's out of control. And so it may not be a whole lot of outward symptoms. People oftentimes will, especially in instances where there's been a completed suicide, say that, as recently as last week, person seemed to be just fine. They were working and, took the kids and did this, and so it's really baffling at times to explain the behavior when you look at what outward things people tend to go by. So in some instances, getting a referral from a doctor or even from a probation officer may be the difference that saves a man from ever having to resort to, something more aggressive like becoming suicidal, and that's one of the things that we do know and about men in general, especially as compared to women, is that the time from sort of becoming having suicidal ideations to actually attempting it is much shorter, and the attempts tend to be far more fatal in a far more frequent rate than for women. So.
Wow.
And when you actually talk to family members, and I've certainly had in my career the unfortunate experience of having to follow up on a completed suicide, a lot of times that's the feedback you get is, maybe he said he was, just a little bothered by something, but this is just nothing I ever expected.
Wow. Just not even realizing it. So what I want to do is summarize what I've heard for those that may be struggling and not even aware that they're struggling is low self-esteem, possibly suicidal thoughts, loss of interest in activities that they're usually involved in, fatigue, sleep disturbances, sexual problems, including a reduced sex drive. Did I say substance abuse, drug and alcohol abuse? Did I leave out anything?
Well, if I can just add maybe decreased energy levels, difficulty concentrating, sometimes insomnia, some restlessness, irritability, those are some things that certainly are symptomatic of depression and should be looked at carefully.
So those are symptoms to be that people can look at and say, man, that may be going on with me. Maybe I need to go and talk to somebody or see a professional. Even if you start with your general practitioner, your general doctor, they can refer you or provide medication to help you with that. Bishop Garner, I have been wanting to address this issue for a long time with mental health issues in the church. And today we're talking about depression, and later on I want to have you back on the show so we can talk more about just mental health issues in general. But how do you deal with individuals that, and I've heard things like some see it as a punishment from God that they're struggling with this because of some great sin that they did, and so they don't have a tendency to seek help or to seek out help because they feel like this is their punishment and this is what they deserve as some form of sin. How do you deal with those type of issues when you have somebody in front of you that have those beliefs?
One of the first things I let folk know, or someone who is in that position know, is that depression is not a direct result of sin. That's not always the case. I believe that depression is certainly an attack, and it's spiritual for me. Mm-hmm. I understand that, you know, if we look at it from a spiritual context, that, you know, God desires his people to have joy. And the Bible says unspeakable joy, exceeding joy. That's his wish for people in his body. But I have to look at the other side. You know, there's another spirit out there that desires that we experience just the opposite, you know, darkness, sadness, despair, and hopelessness. And so I speak to those issues. You know, I have to let folks know that, you know, depression is not something caused by God. He doesn't desire his people to be sad, to be hopeless, to be helpless. That's not his desire. And, you know, I don't overload folks with scriptures, but there are enough examples in the Word of God that certainly point to God's desire for us.
And Dr. Bullock, how do you deal with that issue of spirituality or religion when you have those in front of you that are feel that it's some form of punishment?
Well, given that the majority of the time I have the scenarios I stated in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
Clients who come and you have to build a trusting relationship, I found that if I can get to a place where we can have a conversation about on a spiritual level, that I've made a whole lot of progress mm-hmm. with building that bond, and I have a pretty strong engagement with the client so that we are able to at that point really aggressively to treat the depressive symptoms, to address the other areas that of this person's life that may be impacted by, you know, other situations outside of the depression, and just help them with their coping skills. So I actually sometimes think about clients in terms of if they come to me initially as a visitor, my goal is to work towards building the kind of relationship so they become customers. And that would certainly be a characteristic of a client that's a customer relationship. We're talking about your spiritual life, which is, to me, one of the most intimate parts of the self. And if we can talk about that, then we're on a pretty good road.
Okay. And then you also have those in the church that believe, because we've all seen this as clinicians, we've all seen the issue of individuals not taking their medication because they're just going to pray, or at least I have, they're going to pray and just turn it over to God. How do you deal with those issues?
Well, I certainly have had that experience, and I tell folks that, listen, you can still pray, you can still turn it over to the Lord, but God has given you a way. He's given you an opportunity through prayer, through fasting, and through medication to take care of whatever you need done. And so I encourage people who are on medication to continue taking their medication.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bullock, how do you deal with those issues of I'm just going to pray and turn it over to God and individuals not taking their medication?
Well, medication compliance in general is difficult for people, particularly when it comes to the side effects. And probably more the reason for being non-compliant with medication tends to, in my counseling setting, to be more associated with side effects than a pure spiritual or religious purpose for not wanting to take it. And that certainly is a struggle. It's true not just for depression, but for a lot of the other major physical problems that that our black men tend to have to deal with, like high blood pressure. Whether it's the way that it makes them feel, whether it's an impact on their body physically as far as weight gain or fluid, or sometimes even impacting their sexual dysfunction. Those are the kinds of things that we end up talking about. And, you know, there is always the alternative to use psychotherapy to try to treat the depression, with the idea that if the symptoms don't improve, and there are ways of monitoring whether the symptoms are proven or not. There's a lot of clinical instruments out there that you can build into the therapeutic environment. But if the symptoms aren't improving, then we can kind of come back to a discussion of medication. So there's a certain amount of negotiation that goes on with that. And a lot of it has to do with the outcomes.
Okay. How would an individual know? Because, you know, a lot of times we've also seen patients that will take their medication and then they start to feel better. And because they're feeling better, they feel that they don't need the medication anymore. So how would you make that distinction, or help an individual make the distinction between they're feeling better because of the medication, or they're feeling better because they are getting better? How do you help them make that distinction?
Well, for me, I know that one of the agreements that we try to establish is that no decision will be made without us discussing it, that the person won't take themselves off without discussing it as a part of. And that's, again, part of really having a healthy therapeutic relationship, is to be able to create the kind of trust where, your client can come in and tell you, this is what I'm thinking. And then we can kind of discuss. And as I said, there's always a negotiation process, so that even if a person wanted to have a trial period of operating without the medication, we can plan it so that, all the precautions are taken and have a way of responding to it if it's not working really well. But, you know, a lot of the times you see in the research literature information about psychotherapy by itself versus the combination of psychotherapy and medication when it comes to treating depression. And there certainly is statistics and data that supports using psychotherapy by itself. But again, when you're dealing with something as serious as major depression, you have to have a scenario where you can have some agreements that you negotiate with your client.
And I concur with Dr. Bullock. I'm not in a position to advise someone one way or the other as to whether or not he or she should take medication. I would always advise that the individual seek competent medical advice before making any decision. And hopefully, prayerfully, if there is a therapeutic relationship or alliance established, that person is going to talk to me. Can't assure it, but the hope is that we'll have a discussion, and I will recommend that the discussion be furthered with the doctor.
Okay. And someone mentioned earlier in our culture, in our community, sometimes it's more difficult to get individuals to come in and seek treatment until it's already out of control. What social factors do we need to take into consideration as we're trying to educate those that may be struggling with this and may not be aware or are not willing to accept the diagnosis of depression?
Well, I'll take a stab at that. One of the things that's true about you know, African American cultures, if you look at, for example, my music, and if you look at the history of the blues, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, all of the history we've had trying to establish ourselves as a group that's going to be recognized as a people, and you know, all of the things that go with that. But when you kind of grow up with almost a cultural but almost a stigma type of a value that says that being blue is a part of being black, you know, that is real hard to overcome. And you combine that with the general sort of men, boys transitioning to men, and you're supposed to handle your own problems, and, you know, so if you have the two of those integrated into a young man's life, it makes it very difficult for a person to seek treatment on their own, and then come in there and just, you know, sort of talk about it. And again, that's not just for mental illness; that's for medical problems too. And I've actually worked in smaller communities where there was just a lack of trust in the local hospitals and the doctors that worked there, so that there's the other sort of saying or value in the community where people actually said, you know, the only way I'll go to that hospital is feet first, which means that your condition will be chronic in late stage before you'd even go to the hospital. So if you're talking about people that live in a community like that, you know, you have some tremendous self-imposed barriers that a person would have to get through just to be in front of a professional.
And I want to piggyback on that. You talk about the social factors. You know, we talk about a lot of things in our community, but we don't talk about mental health. We don't talk about depression. We don't talk about addiction enough. And I think that's the key. We're closed in a lot of ways. And the stigma that depression carries in and of itself is a social albatross. And so no one wants to deal with it in a very open way. And if you want to talk about football or basketball or other things, you can get a discussion from A to Z. But when it comes to this very real issue, there's silence, and I like to call it, you know, part of that silent frustration syndrome.
I'm gonna have to use that one, silent frustration syndrome. Go ahead.
We just don't talk about these types of things. Consequently, it begins to affect us from the inside out. But if we can just get men to talking, whether it's in a church environment, whether it's in the community, or whatever the case may be, in a therapeutic environment, then we can move it from that Jahari's window, you know, that pain, that part of me that nobody knows but me, to that side where everybody is engaged in open discussion, and I think that's important.
Okay. And both of you have hit on some very important key points. Dr. Bullock mentioned the lack of trust within the community with hospitals and medical environment in general, and that's why we often turn to the church. In our history, we've always gone to the church for whatever it was that we needed, but sometimes that's just not enough. I would never say that but sometimes we just need to talk to somebody. I'll put it that way. And this is for both of you, a question for both of you, how do you think, or what do you think we need to do, because both of you also spoke of educating and overcoming barriers of all of the self-imposed restrictions that we put on ourselves and as a community. What do you think we need to do, or how do we begin to start to tear down and break through some of those barriers so that people can begin to talk and so that they can begin to come together in whatever environment, be it in front of a professional or in the church or amongst themselves? How do we start to break those barriers and to educate?
I think a couple things that I've had a chance to participate in that I thought, when targeted in particular communities, really got a positive response was doing the community health fairs. They tend to get a great response, especially if it's well organized and well promoted. People do come out, and a lot of times there's professionals there that if somebody wanted to talk right away, they could. But even if somebody just comes by a table and picks up a brochure, you know, that's the kind of information distribution that I think, whether it's an event that's organized by the churches in the community or a combination of a church and a healthcare system in the community. Because, again, if it's a known issue that you have a community that has a lack of trust for the hospital and the medical people that are responsible really for that treating that community, there should be some dialogue between leaders in the community and these health systems, because we know that we have people in those communities that need the help. There are a lot of doctors that are willing to do pro bono work if people don't have insurance, and so you build those relationships so that you can get this kind of event organized, and it does, people do come out in a, you know, I kind of equivalent it to people that organize their own yard sale. You know, you drive by the community and somebody has a yard sale going, and curiosity makes you pull over, you see stuff out, you see a few people standing around, and that's the attraction. You know, you put some balloons up and you get some core people that's going to come, and then as folks are kind of moving around, especially if it's in a prominent place in the community, other people will stop in and grab a brochure or, you know, actually talk to somebody.
And I want to say that there used to be a time when the church had its finger on the pulse of the community. And I agree with you, Dr. Bullock, that the church is a wonderful, wonderful vehicle to get the word out. The health fairs are great. They're effective. I know that in my church we have what's called the care ministries, and we have nurses, we have counselors, we have professionals in place who are more than capable of providing some very good information to not just the church members, but the community at large. And it's a responsibility of the church to go out into the hedges and highways, not just to preach the gospel, but to also be like Christ. I mean, he went around and about doing good. And so it's the responsibility of the church to go about their business doing good, looking for opportunities to help and to bless others. And this is one way of doing it. It's a wonderful vehicle.
Are there any other vehicles or any other ways or systems that we could use to start to educate individuals?
I know one of the things that I'm really have been kind of watching it grow probably over the last 20 years is the addition of EAP, an EAP component to almost every place, almost every workplace. And I think that having done a little bit of EAP work in my career, that this is another place where people, you know, it was mentioned earlier, I think, that sometimes it's a coping mechanism for problems, whether it's depression or otherwise, is to increase the amount of, you know, time we spend at work. Now, if that's happening, and as a result of the things that are going on outside of work, a person's performance starts to suffer, this EAP is a confidential environment where a person can go and seek help and get a referral. And I think that is a very, very powerful addition to the workforce, because most of us work full time. We spend more time there than we do, you know, anywhere else, just trying to make a living. And so if you have that kind of resource available, people can certainly try to take advantage of that resource without continuing to have a drop in their performance. And sometimes a supervisor can just make that one little nudge that makes a difference in a person's ability to be more open to getting some help.
Are there any leaders? How can leaders start to? Because for me personally, I think that leaders have a certain level of responsibility to help get to educate the public and to educate those that they serve. How can leaders begin to get more involved in the issue? You know, both of you have mentioned the church, and the church has always been the forefront, and we've already established that throughout history. Our community, and especially the African-American community, has always gone to the church as opposed to going to, other community resources. So how can we start to hold leaders accountable and get them out there on the forefront to educating and dispelling some of the myths about mental health?
Well, I think that, certainly the civic organizations have a voice and have the opportunity to reach the local politicians to express those things that are important to the community, those things that are important to them. And I think it's important for them to put that information out there and look for some feedback, look for at least something very tangible. Not just lip service. And so that's one way, I think, of getting the leaders involved.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that as we continue to progress, more and more African-American men and women find themselves in leadership positions, recognizing that responsibility. I mean, we know no one knows the kinds of problems we have in our community better than we do. So, for example, one of the things that that I'm taking on is looking at, as a part of being a public servant, to look at our penetration rates of our program into the various communities that I work, and try to build a bridge so that people know that even if they don't have any resources at all, they can come and get some help, and identify who those key leaders are in the various communities to be able to have that communication, so that if somebody's, whether it's a person in the church who has people in their congregation that need help, they think of us as a resource, as well as people who are in the school system, as well as people who are in the criminal justice system, you know, and the healthcare system, mm-hmm. Just to name a few.
How do we begin to, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it allows me to piggyback a little bit off my next question, or leads into my next question. How do we begin to address the lack of trust that we have within the medical field, all of those different all the different resources that are available, but we don't use because of a lack of mistrust? How do we start to bridge that gap?
Well, one of the things that being, again, working in the public for a public agency is, while as professionals we get trained quite a bit around how important it is to protect a person's information, there still are those instances where there's a breach somewhere. And that is the kind of thing that, being in a leadership role, I have a very, very low tolerance for. It's already difficult enough for people to come in, and they have their guards up, and they realize that there may be some instances, certain people that they have to agree to release their information to. But really beyond that, you know, there's the barrier that if you do even use, say, your insurance to get some assistance, people worry about if you, for example, have a high security clearance, you know, the impact of even going to get a physical, you know, and getting a particular diagnosis or something, how that could impact your job. That is a social, I mean, that's a problem, you know, that's not just limited to black men, but generally, I mean, that's the kind of thing that will discourage people from going on and talking to a professional about anything if they feel that it could impact their livelihood. And there certainly are certain jobs that kind of create almost a sense of paranoia about that. The other thing is that you can go because you have a particular difficult period in your life and find later on when you're trying to get some life insurance that your rate's going to be phenomenal. So that kind of stuff gets out and people say, man, you know, should I go in? I know I've had a history of hypertension, you know, and try to get this life insurance policy before, you know, something happens and people tell me I'm even not insurable. I mean, so you got, those are some of the other kinds of things that become barriers for people beyond what they're physically or emotionally dealing with.
Bishop Garner, how do you think we can start to help people address just that general issue of mistrust that we have within our community and with the healthcare system and with some of the other resources that are out there and available but we don't use because of our barriers of mistrust?
Well, I certainly think that we need to get some information out there. Information is power, and a lot of folks are operating without the information they need to make informed decisions. There has been a general mistrust in our community as a whole. And so when you educate me, when you inform me, when you let me know everything there is to know, you put it out on the table, and then you allow me to make decisions. And if I have questions, you give me a vehicle or a way to address those questions, there's a certain level of comfort. Certainly there are perceptions out there. There are paradigms that need to be moved around and addressed. But if you give me the right information, then I can make an informed decision and go from there. When I know what I need to know, then I'm more comfortable.
Okay. Confidence is also has come up, especially with me and working with clients. What advice would you give those listeners that are maybe considering going but want to make sure that they're with a competent professional? How would you go about looking for, or what would you look for when looking for a competent professional that could help me with whatever issue that may, not just depression, but with whatever issue may be going on? What are some of the things that you would look for?
I would say, if you have the resources to be able to shop around, that you kind of approach a therapeutic kind of a relationship with the idea that the first person you see may not be a good match for you, but you can win it with an open mind and you're not afraid to ask questions, not only about a person's training, background, and credentials, but just generally about the course of treatment. You know, a lot of times people will see counselors sort of as an authority or an expert and defer and feel that they can't really have input in the process. And a good therapist will be sure to be inclusive as a part of putting together any kind of a treatment plan that has input from the client. But, you know, that said, it's important for a client to see themselves, a person to see themselves as, you know, as a customer, and therefore, you know, I come in with my own questions. I think about what I expect, and certainly get a chance to say those things and see what kind of our relationship we can build from there.
And I certainly agree with everything that you said, Dr. Bullock. And, you know, I would want to have someone that I can actually have input with that we join together, although this individual obviously is a therapist. I want to be a part of that that treatment. I just don't want to be sitting on the outside getting the information, but I want to actually be involved in my own treatment. And I would suggest that when one looks for the right therapist, the right match, that it's someone that will allow the counselee to be involved with the process.
And one of the things that I want to point out, because I've often found in working with clients, is that they may have started out with seeing a psychiatrist, and I really want to be able to make the distinction between a psychologist and a psychiatrist and the different levels of licensures that you may go in seeking counseling. A psychiatrist generally prescribes medication, but they don't do counseling and psychotherapy. Psychologists, licensed clinical social workers, and licensed professional counselors would be the ones that would provide psychotherapy, counseling, and treatment planning, all of those things that we talked about. And I've often found that in working with clients that I would have to explain the differences, because they would complain that their psychiatrist, you know, doesn't talk to them. He only spends 10 or 15 minutes with them and then gives them another prescription. And then I have to explain, well, that's what they do. You need to be, you know, that's why you're here to see me, to talk about and work through whatever issues. So I thought that was important to put that out there. We're getting close to time. One of the other things that I really want to make sure that we talk about really quick is suicide awareness, because a lot of times if the issues aren't addressed with depression, and Dr. Bullock mentioned earlier in the show that men are more likely to commit suicide, what would be some of the signs of that someone, and sometimes you can't tell, but what would be some of the signs that someone is contemplating suicide? How would you know?
I'll take a shot at that. One of the things that, again, it becomes very complicated if it's a scenario where a person's become emotionally closed off to the degree that they're really good at showing the better side of themselves to the people that are close to them, so that they really don't see the pain, the pressure, the confusion that might be going on underneath. But somewhere along the line, there's an effort to reach out. And just to give you an example, I've had a scenario where a person came into the lobby of a mental health clinic, and the receptionist asked the person to wait, and the person said, "I really need to speak to someone right now." And the person said, "Well, there's several people ahead of you, and you just need to wait, and we'll get with you in a minute." And the person walked out of the door, and within an hour or so, committed suicide.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, you have, you know, the replay of that, and you say, well, this is a person who got to the doors of a mental health clinic asking for help and was delayed because, you know, there were some people there that just weren't responsive to the urgency of the situation, and that ended up being a fatal scenario. So generally you can't really take any complaint for granted.
So you want to ask, and you want to take them seriously.
Absolutely.
When they're and
if a person says, you know, sometimes I just think about, you know, ending it all, you never underestimate the realness of that. And even if they sort of have a soft laugh behind it, you know, and say, well, but then again, you know, who doesn't? That can sometimes throw people to think that, okay, well, you know, I just sort of let that one go right on by. Mm-hmm. But it's the kind of thing that if you ever hear something like that, it's certainly worth the investment to follow up, because
And we,
if you know you've heard that and, you know, and you ignored it and 2 weeks later the person's gone, it's too late.
Right, and I hate to cut you off, Dr. Bullock, but we are almost out of time. I want to make sure that we get the suicide prevention number if you're contemplating or if you just have questions about depression. It's 1-800-784-2433. And unfortunately, we are out of time. I would like to thank my guest again for coming, and I would definitely like to have the both of you back on the show to discuss this and other mental health issues. Again, this is Inspire Perspective, where life is about choices. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.